Morning, everybody. This is News Radio 94.9 890 KDXU. It's Wednesday and time for Pathway Hospice and Palliative Care Show. Here's Richard and Kaylee.
And welcome to Wellness Wednesday. And this is Elder Care Radio, brought to you by Pathway Hospice and Palliative Care. My name is Richard, and my lovely wife Kaylee is here with me. And we're going to be talking about something that's a little unusual or uncomfortable, I guess. More uncomfortable, things that we've been trying to, many people try and avoid.
Did you want to first talk about COVID good news?
Oh, okay. Let's talk about some COVID good news.
And,
I think we're all...
Let me stop you here. I noticed you said your lovely wife, Kaylee. You don't talk about that enough, Richard. I think you need to work on that a little more.
Yeah, you don't talk about that enough, Richard.
Sorry, man.
I completely agree that I do not talk about her enough.
Yeah.
But on the COVID good news front, I think we're all starting to hear the news that... It's waning, you know, that, and we don't want to get too excited about this. We certainly don't want to take the position of it doesn't exist and therefore we don't have to worry about it from this point forward. But the statistics show, and as we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, and now the news is finally picking up on that. I'm not claiming that we can control the news, but...
That's good you're not claiming that.
Newsflash, Richard's wife, Kaylee, is lovely. Yeah. See if we can get that in the headlines.
Yes, too. That should be a headline.
Okay, anybody who's listening, let's get that story out. So, yes, we're down quite a bit, and there have been a lot of vaccines given out. However, those vaccines haven't necessarily kept people from getting COVID any more than they didn't get it before. You know, when it's given to healthcare workers who have, you know, been dealing with COVID for 11 months and not contracting the disease, we don't know that the vaccine has done more than that. So it's exciting to know that, you know, we can see the end of the tunnel here and that there will be some changes going forward. We also want everybody to know that for the elderly 70 and over, you can register with the health department here and get a vaccine.
And it's been pretty easy to get on the appointment list. They do have the resources and supplies available, so you just really need to call the health district and make an appointment. It is important to make an appointment. Not only are they trying to have social distancing, but the vaccine itself is very fragile, so they actually have to take it out of the freezer, a deep, deep freezer, and thaw the number of vials that they expect to use in that day. So if you don't show up, sometimes those syringes are wasted. So it's important to make your appointment and then show up for your appointment.
By the way, Dave Heaton from the health department said their appointments filled up in 10 minutes for this week. On Monday from 9 to 9:10, at that point they were full.
Right.
So the problem is they're not getting enough right now. And as soon as they get enough, then everybody will get it. But they're focusing on our senior population first.
Well, they did just get another large supply. So yeah, they do have, based on the information we received yesterday, they have sufficient supply. It's really just managing the appointments to get it out there. One of the things that those of you who have been watching the news that is still good news is that the surge from the holidays seems to have been far less than projected, and they believe it's over. So that's great. The surge has passed, so we're on a downward trend.
So hopefully we can start enjoying the weather as soon as that clears up here in southern Utah and just get out and start enjoying our lives again and not worry so much about this. And that's really has been our goal with the COVID good news over the past number of months, is that we can stop worrying so much about things we can't control. So today we've been doing some research and we wanted to bring up a topic that really could use some better information out there. And I believe it's one of those topics that that people don't want to talk about. Andy, do you know anybody who is suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia? And you don't have to give any names.
Yeah, a couple people, yeah.
Besides ourselves, that
yeah,
is.
Besides us.
Yeah, I know a couple. In fact, I've become good friends with Mike Miller from the Alzheimer's Association.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
Supportive of him and the Color Purple.
Sure.
As they try to raise awareness for Alzheimer's. It's a disease that they're getting close to figuring out what's causing it, and when you get what's causing it, you can battle it happening. So, but yeah, I do know a couple.
There is definitely a lot more information available today, which is wonderful news. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of what we wanted to talk about today. We've had our whole goal in this community is to educate the community, inform the community. We are constantly reaching out, doing research, adding to the resources and educational information available. There have been several seminars on dementia and Alzheimer's and how to treat our loved ones or how to communicate better with our loved ones that are struggling with this disease. And so we've attended a few of the seminars. One of them in particular was held by the University of Utah College of Social Work. It was headed by Troy Christian Anderson. He's a PhD, has his Master of Social Work, his license, clinical license of social work. He's an associate professor and lecturer. So he's got a wealth of information available.
And he gave a perspective on dementia and Alzheimer's from a social worker's position. And then we have another seminar that we attended from Jeanette Kolsky, who is an occupational therapist, registered and licensed. And so it's two different perspectives on the same issue. But I think one of the important things that we kind of come to grips with is that dementia and Alzheimer's is one of those things that maybe we've been trying to avoid anybody finding out about. I know many of the people who have it naturally don't want anybody to know. They're not actively trying to do that, but they try and function in society, and sometimes they will, you know, hide the facts that they aren't as aware as they used to be. And as families go, we try to maybe not let everybody in the community know because we think it's something bad, kind of like, you know, wetting the bed as a child. I think we'd be surprised at how many people wet the bed if we ever had that conversation. But so we hope we're going to open this conversation up a little bit.
But let's start out by giving credit to the families and caregivers of those with this very difficult disease. It's hard to watch our loved ones disappear before our eyes, and somebody that we love so much find it hard to communicate with them and find ways to get them to do what we need them to do so that we can care for them when they don't understand. I've watched several children struggle with just really an inability to accept that it's not personal when their mother or father no longer recognizes them or won't communicate with them or won't do what they're asking them to do when it's all with love that they're trying to get them to, you know, act.
And as everybody changes, you know, through this mental decline or through these, you know, just life changes and transition points, we need to be aware of what works and what doesn't, and be adaptive. And I think many of the things we may hold as useful may not be. And so we're going to cover some things. We don't expect that we're going to be able to answer everybody's questions here. Certainly, there's a whole lot more information. What we're hoping to do, all we want to do is give those people who are dealing with this some key points that they can start with. We are available to answer questions, and we will point you to the same information that's available to us. We'll always point you to Mike at the Alzheimer's Association because he's a great resource. And if you're struggling with this, we hope that what we can accomplish today is to show you that your struggles may not have to be quite what they are today. We don't have any easy answers. There's nothing that's going to make this easy, but hopefully there are some things that we can give you that may make it a little easier. And that's all we're going to be able to accomplish today. We hope that works. For those of you who don't know anybody with Alzheimer's or dementia, you probably just don't know that you know.
Brings us to utilizing procedural memory as a means to increase ADL participation for those with dementia. It's quite interesting as you start to understand or communicate with those around us that do have dementia, their ability to act in a way that seems very appropriate. Sometimes we're left wondering how bad their dementia is in the beginning because their procedural memory takes over and they respond correctly.
Yeah, they can come up with a correct response to a question or what is a reasonable response and giving you an example. If you were to ask somebody who's suffering from dementia at a particular level what they had for breakfast this morning. They may not remember what they had for breakfast this morning, but they will be able to give you an answer as to what breakfast they might remember having had at one point. So they may have had oatmeal this morning, but if you ask them, they'd say, yes, I had eggs and toast. And that's because they're not trying to lie to you. They're trying to answer the question with the information that they have. And it's just the limitation of their mind at that point. And these are all indicators that help us find a level that we can work with them. And as we go through this, there's just so many aspects to it. So one of the things that I got out of this was talking about procedural memory. And they talked about the different kinds of memory that we have. In the long-term category, that breaks down into two general levels, procedural memory and declarative memory. And without definitions, we wouldn't know what those are. So declarative memory are details and facts and all of the things that surround the action that we do. And procedural memory is just the action. Examples of procedural memory are brushing your teeth, getting out of bed in the morning, tying your shoes. These are not things that we actually think about, but that our body does remember how to do.
Right. We've been doing them for so long that it's a procedural memory in that we act without giving it too much thought.
Right. So our bodies can do those jobs, and those procedural memories are usually the things that last the longest. So when we're trying to work with somebody who is suffering from these different types of dementia, it makes sense to try and work with them on a procedural level instead of a declarative level where we're talking to them and explaining things. And that's one of the important things. Just, and again, they used a lot of words. We're going to throw these out and hopefully give some definitions, and that's a good place to start. They talk about environmental cues and errorless learning. Well, errorless learning does not mean learning with no errors. They break it down into two categories. Traditional learning is we're told to do something and then we execute it. Errorless learning is we are given a task that we follow and we are helped to do that correctly. So we're getting dressed in the morning, if that's going to be the case. We could tell somebody all day who does, let's talk about a two-year-old, okay? Because at some point, that may be where we're at. Mm-hmm. If you tried to explain to a two-year-old the process of getting ready, would they be successful at that?
No.
Not at all.
Not at all.
So we want to do a procedural memory thing where we just hand them the clothes and maybe indicate how they're supposed to put those clothes on. And if we can build those procedural memories throughout the day, then we're going to accomplish it. And we have to depend on mostly the procedural memories that people already have.
And then those cues, I loved what they said about the cues. So for instance, if we want our loved one to get dressed in the morning, rather than approach them with the conversation about what we're going to, let's get dressed, put the clothing on the bed. That immediately gives a long range past memory of why would the clothes be on the bed? What happens when that happens? And it sets the pace of it's time to get dressed.
So that's known as an environmental cue. We put something into the environment that they will recognize and trigger on. And that's a great part of this learning. And again, these are may seem like simple steps, but when you're in the throes of a daily life of trying to get things done, we may find that we're not directed in those ways. So we just want to revisit that. So if we can give people those types of cues to begin with, then we can get started. So if we just look at the beginning of the day, how do we get out of bed? They raise the question, do you get out of bed the same way you do today that you did 25 years ago?
No, much slower.
Yeah, I'm a lot slower. And yet, if we look, and these are the problems that the person with Alzheimer's or dementia has, their memory may be from 25 years ago. The way they get out of bed is kind of the way they did 25 years ago, maybe not as fast. And so it's going to be confusing that they're not there. So we're going to try and give them cues along the way. So a toothbrush is a great cue. You know, if they go into the bathroom and there's a toothbrush on the counter, then that's going to be a better cue than the toothbrush in the drawer, because they may not recognize the drawer as a place to go for this toothbrush. So if we can set these things out and provide them in a pattern that they can deal with, then we can accomplish some great things. And we should be happy that they are going to be happier having accomplished some things, and it'll make our lives just a little bit easier.
Hopefully we'll recognize that if we will do these environmental cues, I'm sorry, I'm tongue-tied here today, but if we will do these environmental cues, it will eliminate some of the frustration on our dementia loved ones, hopefully reducing some of the aggression or the anger that is associated with their own frustration within themselves. They can't necessarily recognize or identify why they're frustrated and don't know what you want from them, can't express that, and that becomes aggression sometimes. So by putting the environmental clues there and speaking slowly and calmly from a direction that a toddler might understand better, it will hopefully eliminate for you some of the anger and aggression.
Well, and you bring up a good point. You know, how somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia may respond to us or to the environment may not be what we would expect, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't appropriate for them. And so, you know, one of the things we have to consider when we're dealing with this is especially the level at which they function. We have to set the tasks and the goals within something that's attainable for them. Going back to the errorless learning, one of the most important things when we're trying to teach is that we set the standard at a point that they can be successful. We don't want to set the standard at what we want to accomplish. We want to set a standard that makes them successful in what they do. And we may have to reduce the level of success in order to do that, because it's, again, our overall goal is to help the person that has the problem live the fullest life possible. And if they're living a better life, they're going to be much more capable of letting you live a better life. But Kaylee brought up a good point that the response may not be what we expect. So, for instance, if you were to go in the morning, first thing, the person's just getting out of bed, and you come at them with a bunch of clothes and start grabbing at them to get their pajamas off, they may punch you in the face. And we would think that's the wrong response. But if we look at it from their position of, I don't know what's happening, I'm being attacked, mm-hmm. Then I'm going to respond that way. So we
especially remembering that their cognitive ability is slower. So they may be at a fight or flight response mm-hmm. first, because that is the procedural response from their memory bank, and they're not able to process quite as quickly as you are expecting them to. So their response is, whoa, slow down, this is scary, this is aggressive. So your intent is just to help them, but their understanding and cognitive ability is, somebody's coming at me and trying to take my clothes off, and they haven't even processed really who you are or what your intent is. It's impossible for them. We have to take it from their perspective and constantly readjust them and reorient them back to what your plan is, what your intent is, who you are, and that you're trying to help them. And go slow and be calm.
And it's really our responsibility as the caregiver or as somebody who's working with them to try and read their responses and find out why. If they are showing anger or aggression, we need to look at why they're doing that. It may be the only way they can communicate, but does that mean that they are in pain? They may not be able to explain the pain they have, but they are trying to notify somebody that there's a problem. And so that may be their response. It could be that they're fatigued, that it's been a long day, and they just don't. I mean, I've had long days, and when people come at me, I don't always respond in the most appropriate way.
That's true.
One of the key things that we need to really focus on is that at these levels, when people are dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, is that it's more emotion than reason, and we have to address their emotions. We can't reason with them. You know, we can't just explain to them why they're wrong. We really have to just read their own emotions and figure that out. So if it's anger or aggression, is there physical discomfort? Are they fatigued? Are they overstimulated? And that's one of the things I hope we can talk about today, is trying to reduce sources of stimulation, because that's going to be important. If they're showing anxiety or agitation, what are the issues? Is there something new in the environment? Are they in a different place than they feel comfortable? When some of the things that are noticed is, you know, if you're traveling and all of a sudden they're in a totally new world, that can be very difficult for them to deal with. And so they may show anxiety. Are there small changes? Like, is the caregiver arrangement a little different? Is the schedule different? Are those kind of things happening? And so if we are able to read these emotional responses, we may be able to make some changes. Figure out what the environmental trigger is that causes that response, and let's remove it. In fact, one of the important things for people suffering here is that our world is extremely complex, and they're not able to deal with a complex world as well. So if we can remove things that cause complexity, even those things we may feel should be familiar for them, you know, let's say the bedroom environment, you've got all the pictures of all the family on the wall, and they're at a level that they don't recognize the family. But now they have these pictures on the wall that keep drawing their attention. And that means that they have less attention to focus on the task. So if we can simplify the environment significantly, that may have a drastic improvement on their ability to cope. If we can give them exercise to do, things to physically, to have some physical activity, that may reduce that. But also just trying to listen to their frustrations. Sit back, be calm, relax, don't set a schedule for this. Let them, you know, deal or express, however they're trying to express what they're doing, and give real consideration to what it is so that we can figure it out, but give them time and be reassuring. And hopefully we can get through that event, and then we can redirect them and then get them back on a task that is going to be useful for them. And then another one that's kind of interesting is the hallucinations and delusions part of this. Some people have those. And what we really have to assess is, are those hallucinations upsetting for the individual? Because they may be seeing things that you don't, and that may be upsetting for you, but is it upsetting for them? And if it's not, then we need to adapt. We need to learn to adapt to these circumstances. If it is a problem, then let's figure out what the cause is, because they are emotionally responding to something. So if we can find out what the cause for the hallucination is, then we can maybe reverse that. And another possibility there, and that one is, maybe they're having sensory loss. Maybe they can't hear as well. Maybe they can't see as well. And if we aren't recognizing that, then we won't know it. So if you can imagine all of a sudden tomorrow you can't hear the same, and things that you're hearing are not making sense, but you're trying to make sense of it.
And you don't know how to express that you can't hear as well, because right. You can't process those words or that understanding.
So we want to remove those things that we can. And mirrors, I'm just going to throw this out. We're almost out of time. Mirrors can be a real distraction, so maybe reducing those in the house. Rugs for, you know, falls. There are just some things we can do in the home that may make some differences.
I'd say the big takeaway here is, if you know somebody, or if you yourself are dealing with a loved one with dementia or Alzheimer's, know that there are resources available. Please give our office a call. We can help you find the resources, get you the education that you need to communicate better with your loved one, so that your life is a little easier, so that your loved one is a little less frustrated and stressed. You can find us on our website at pathwayhospicecare.com, or by giving our office a call at 435-477-6999. Again, it's Pathway Hospice and Palliative Care at 435-477-6999.